Mr. Von Lowe.
Yes.
Good morning to you. You may approach and you may proceed.
Thank you. Justices, counsel, may it please the court. My name is Derek Von Lowe. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Brandon Blake. First thing that I would like to discuss this morning, and that the court had asked for some special briefing regarding jurisdiction in this matter and about whether the appeal was properly perfected and docketed by the court. Our contention is yes, that the appeal was properly docketed and that it was properly perfected under statute. And I think there's a little bit of a misnomer between the statutes that regarding perfection of the appeal and whether or not the rule requiring the informer pauperis affidavit to be within 45 days, which is a Supreme Court rule.
The informer pauperis affidavit is a substitute for the docket, right?
Yes.
And so the docket fee is paid or to be paid at a particular point in time after judgment and within 30 days, right?
Right.
So consequently, isn't the informer pauperis affidavit intended to speak to the defendant's financial situation at that point in time?
Well, and I believe that it can speak to the financial condition of the appellant at that particular moment. However, I don't believe that when you have somebody who is incarcerated, whether there's a certain time period that has to be executed in is required. I don't think it's required as a substantial requirement, especially when the statute says that the appeal is perfected at the time that the affidavit is filed and accepted by the court. And this affidavit had been filed and accepted by the court.
Does the district court judge have discretion to accept a stale affidavit?
I believe they do. I believe that they do have an ability to be able to accept any poverty affidavit that is brought forth to them. And I think whether or not the court thought this was a stale affidavit or not, I think the district court, we have to remember, also knew that Mr. Blake had been incarcerated, was going to be incarcerated for a substantial period of time, and there was probably no information that was going to change. And also, we did file on December 4th of 2020, we did file another poverty affidavit on behalf of Mr. Blake, which was substantially exactly the same affidavit as what was proposed at the beginning.
Circumstance argument?
I don't think there's an exceptional circumstance. I just think that the rule says that the statute says to perfect an appeal, you have to have a poverty affidavit. It needs to be accepted by the court in lieu of the filing fee, which happened in this case. And then we go to the rule.
I'll interrupt real quick. Is there any statutory provision that refers to the timing of the execution of the affidavit?
There is not.
And that's simply a court rule. Is that court rule based upon any statute that you can find?
No, not that I have been able to find. I believe that that's why I argue about whether or not I think if you read the plain language of the rule talks about docketing the case in the Supreme Court or the Court of Appeals. It does not talk about perfection of the appeal. So perfection is only discussed in the statute.
Suppose the case is commenced, and at that moment, at the very beginning, when the complaint is filed, the defendant files an affidavit in form of papyrus. Case proceeds for 3 years. Ultimately, there's a conviction and an appeal is taken. Is that IFP affidavit from 3 years ago sufficient to support the taking of the appeal?
If the district court accepts that affidavit, I would argue yes, because there is no time limit in the statute that requires that the affidavit be done in a certain time period prior to being accepted by the district court in lieu of the filing fee.
So your argument is that the district court should have some kind of hearing as to why the affidavit is still good?
Well, I think the district court could do that. I think it's, I think that is at the discretion of the district court about whether or not they would require a hearing, whether or not they believe that the affidavit is sufficient. And in this case, the judge had determined that the affidavit was sufficient, and therefore the appeal is perfected according to statute.
If IFP is invoked, that means the county is paying the fees, correct?
Yes.
So the protection that's being granted here is so that the county doesn't have to pay fees where they shouldn't have to. That's why the IFP is reviewed at all, correct?
Correct.
Was there any objection made to this affidavit at the time when it was submitted in the district court?
No, there was no objection. There was never any objection until the Court of Appeals and the request for summary dismissal based upon no jurisdiction, and the Court of Appeals dismissed the case. That was the first time that issue was brought forward. Again,
this is Justice Miller-Lerman. I beg your pardon. So is this really a jurisdictional issue, or is this just a defect in pleadings?
Well, I think I would call it more of a defect in pleading than jurisdictional. I think the statute speaks to the jurisdiction. I think that the defect part would go to the rule about whether the case should be docketed by the Supreme Court and when it would be docketed. I think just being docketed does not mean that the appeal doesn't exist. It means that the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court is not going to listen or do anything with the case until that particular rule is met. And I believe that we did meet that by filing of the second property affidavit in this matter that was filed with this court.
Before we expire all of your time, would you like to discuss the merits?
Sure. Absolutely. Thank you, Judge. I would like just, this was an appeal on a plea and a sentencing. I believe that there are several issues that we have briefed about things that were inappropriate or not done by counsel in this case. I believe that, first of all, I think there was an abuse of discretion by the court, considering all of the facts that were in the pre-sentence investigation report that were not, that I believe his sentence was excessive. I believe that there was certain sexual history that should have been brought forward by counsel. That's one of our assignments of errors, that there was ineffective assistance of counsel because some of those things were not brought forward.
Weren't they brought forward in the pre-sentence investigation?
They were in the pre-sentence investigation. And yes, the judge did have an opportunity to review that, and he stated in the record that he did review the pre-sentence investigation. But I think that because there were so many details regarding his sexual history in 75 pages of information from the Department of Social Services that was provided in the pre-sentence investigation, I think that it was very important for counsel to point out some of those issues to the judge because of the fact that he had these sexual proclivities, that maybe this whole thing could have been avoided if there would have been taken proper action.
So are you asserting that counsel did not sufficiently point out to the judge what was in the pre-sentence, or was there something that counsel should have presented that wasn't in the pre-sentence?
No, I believe that the counsel should have highlighted certain things that were in the pre-sentence report to ensure that the judge knew of those items. And even though you get these pre-sentence reports that are hundreds of pages long, and you know, I have some concerns about whether the judge, when they say they review them, what kind of review they get. And that's why I think it's very important that counsel at the time of sentencing needs to point out certain specific things, especially when there are some heavy hitter issues, such as Mr. Blake has.
Okay. The sentence, as far as the sentence was within statutory limits.
It was within statutory limits.
Thank you.
Yes. And the I think the last thing, I think on our ineffective assistance of counsel claims, I think that there are certain issues that can be determined on this appeal for those ineffective assistance of counsel claims. I think that maybe there is one of those issues that is not ripe for decision by this court, but I believe without further hearing. However, I do believe that there were ineffective issues, ineffective assistance of counsel issues that certainly could be determined by this court based upon the record now.
One other point I'd like to bring up to you, when the court, district court granted your client's direct appeal.
Yes.
After post-conviction, it made rulings on the remainder of his claims as well. What should this court do with those?
Well, I don't think that it made rulings that those were not appropriate for post-conviction relief at the time. I don't believe, and I believe that because of the way that they were stated by the appellant himself doing this pro se on his motion for on his post-conviction motion, I think that there are some issues. I don't think there's much to be read into those issues because there was no hearing by the court on those issues. There was no evidence that was ever taken in on those issues. And I believe that I think they're kind of a moot issue that the court shouldn't necessarily concern itself with those issues that were not determined by the district court.
But you would agree your client probably has not lost the right to re-raise those issues in a subsequent post-conviction proceeding as long as he preserved them in this appeal.
As long as he preserves them in this appeal, yes. All right, thank you, I'm out of time.
Thank you very much. Mr. Wiss, good morning to you.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Nathan Liss, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the Appalachian State of Nebraska. The state maintains that this court lacks jurisdiction over this appeal due to the fact that Blake failed to file a proper poverty affidavit, our case law, as well as our statutes and our court rules regarding appellate jurisdiction require that a notice of appeal and either a docket fee or a proper poverty affidavit have to be filed for an appeal to be perfected, and the failure to do so results in an appellate court lacking
jurisdiction. Isn't our jurisdiction statutory?
I'm sorry?
Isn't our jurisdiction established by the statutes?
Jurisdiction generally is established by statute or constitution. Yes.
Okay. And is there anything in the statutes or constitution which makes the requirement for the affidavit to be executed within a certain timeline?
First of all, I would note that our state constitution, Article 5, Section 25, expressly affords this court authority to promulgate rules with respect to practice and procedure as long as they aren't inconsistent with state law. So to the extent this court has done so through constitutional authority, we would submit that that alone could afford your rules to have some jurisdictional effect. But additionally, and probably more importantly, we would submit that the rule in question is directly tied to our state statutory scheme with respect to poverty affidavits, in particular the requirement that when you're perfecting an appeal, you have to file a new poverty affidavit. You can't just use the one that you used at the inception of the case. You got to file a new one, and that affidavit does have to reflect or establish that the person lacks the ability or cannot afford to pay the cost to proceed with that action. So we would submit that that's where this rule ties into that requirement, that statutory requirement, that the poverty affidavit establishes you are currently unable to afford the cost of the proceeding. You can't have a stale poverty affidavit, and that's where the rule ties in.
Is there a timing to see when this should be challenged? Should it be challenged at the time the trial court is making its determination to accept the appeal, or should it be actually brought up before the appellate court as we're doing here?
If I recall 25-1301.02 correctly, the grounds for challenging poverty affidavit that would typically take place in district court are that the person actually has the ability to pay, or that the claims are raising are frivolous or meritless, which is not the case here. What we're dealing with, what we're alleging, is just that the poverty affidavit on its face is legally invalid, which we would submit as a question of law and is incumbent upon this court to decide as a matter of jurisdiction before proceeding with the case. So I don't think it is an issue that typically would be raised below or would be required to be raised pursuant to that statute.
And as a factual matter, this individual had been found to be under IFP before the appeal during his original trial, correct?
Correct.
And is incarcerated since then. Is that correct?
I'm not sure. I assume so, but
okay.
I don't know that to be a fact.
Just for what we... presumption that can be made is that his financial situation has not improved since he went to prison.
That's possible and likely. I mean, we don't know. I mean, you don't know.
It's also
somebody inherits money. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's what I was just going to say. It's also possibly could have had an inheritance.
It's possible. Right. We don't know. Right. And that's our position is that the rule and really we're not really even relying entirely on the rule. We're reading the rule in conjunction with the state statutory scheme and really as a mechanism to enforce the state statutory scheme, which requires that poverty affidavits establish that he is currently unable to afford the proceeding in question. And in this case, that would be the appeal.
What do we do with, under your argument, with 29-2306, the language that opposing counsel relied on? If an application to proceed in forma pauperis is filed and granted, the Court of Appeals or Supreme Court shall acquire jurisdiction.
Well, this court has said in the Roofin case cited in my brief and in several others, the fact that a district court has granted a motion to proceed in forma pauperis is essentially immaterial. If the appeal was not actually properly perfected and that poverty affidavit was in fact invalid and insufficient, the fact that the district court granted it doesn't matter.
But what do we do with that language? I mean, it says shall acquire jurisdiction, doesn't that?
It does, but this court has interpreted that to mean.
Were that interpretation correct? Can you square that interpretation with the language?
I believe the interpretation was correct, and the legislature is well aware of what you said. They've acquiesced. I mean, those decisions have been on the books. Several of them have been on the books for years.
How do you get that out of that language?
Well, reading the plain language. I mean, I see what you're saying, but it's. I beg your pardon.
Is this a helpful inquiry? Is a overdue, quote, stale affidavit, is that a jurisdictional problem under statutes and constitution, perhaps court rule, or is it just merely a defect in the proceedings and then defects of such nature can be waived?
Well, it's our position that it's jurisdictional. If the court concludes otherwise, we would maintain that it is at least a defect similar to 9E or something of that nature that could lead to a lack of appellate review for failure to comply with your rules. But our position, first and foremost, is that it's jurisdictional. And just to revisit your question real quickly, Justice Papik, with respect to a district court granting a poverty affidavit, in this case in particular, one thing I'd point out is that the district court in this case actually granted his motion to proceed in form paupers before he even filed his affidavit. So the fact that a district court has granted it shouldn't be the end all be all. And our case law says that it isn't. And as far as this court's interpretations, I mean, as this court's well aware, you oftentimes have to take a statute that may not be entirely clear, may not cover or encompass every possible scenario and look at what makes sense and what doesn't. I think these court's decisions are correct. And I would also point out that when you look at our statutory scheme, there's actually nothing in there that directly says poverty affidavits are jurisdictional. I mean, it says that a court requires jurisdiction when the notice of appeal is filed and when the statutory docket fee is paid. I mean, there's nothing in there that directly says, you know, that the poverty affidavit will be jurisdictional. Obviously, the statute says you can use it in lieu of it, but that language doesn't specifically say that. We've interpreted that to.
Well, should there be some kind of inquiry down below that the judge or the county ask the judge to take some look behind the curtain in regard to, for example, in this case, a one day late file, and what the reason was for that, and whether or not this is in fact not a stale affidavit.
Well, I mean, I think courts should be taking a closer look at that to ensure that the documents in front of them are proper before they're granting IFP status. I mean, whether or not a particular procedure is in place for that, I'm not really sure, other than our statutory scheme, which requires the appropriate documents to be on file. I guess I'm not quite sure how else to answer that. I mean, due diligence should be exercised before IFP is granted. The appellant also pointed to the fact that they do have a an additional poverty affidavit on file that they're alleging is sufficient and would nonetheless satisfy the IFP or the poverty affidavit requirement in this case if the initial one was invalid. I would note, first of all, I glanced at that, and on the face of that document, I'm not entirely sure it was even filed with the district court. There's the only file stamp I see on that is from the clerk of this court. And then additionally, I would point out that that one was filed well out of time. So even if that one would have been sufficient, it was filed well outside of the 30-day appeal time period. So as our case law establishes, an untimely poverty affidavit is not going to be sufficient to establish jurisdiction or to perfect an appeal. For all of those reasons, if the court has no further questions on the jurisdiction, jurisdictional issue, we would maintain that the insufficient poverty affidavit in this case was a jurisdictional defect and that this court, as a result, lacks jurisdiction. If this court concludes otherwise and finds that it has jurisdiction, we maintain that Blake is not entitled to relief on his claims because they're either without merit or the record is insufficient to address his claims. I don't really have anything to add to the responses set forth in my brief, so I'll stand on those responses and submit the matter unless the court has questions on any of the particular claims. So in sum, we would request that you...
I will
sorry.
Say a question to you at the end that I did with your opponent. With regard to the remaining claims of the original post-conviction, after the direct appeal was reinstated for the defendant, what should we do with the ruling on those remaining claims?
If I recall correctly, the court... And I apologize if I missed this, but my recollection was that the court just held those under advisement and didn't actually really render a ruling and then just granted the new direct appeal. I mean, even if it did render a ruling, it doesn't matter under Dieterman and Kolb-Jorgensen, however you say that, in light of the fact that a new direct appeal is granted. So to answer your question, now that a new direct appeal is here, yes, I think that any and all claims, as long as they've been preserved on direct appeal here, would be fair game in a subsequent post-conviction proceeding, if that answers your question. In sum, we'd ask you dismiss this case for lack of jurisdiction, or alternatively, if you find you have jurisdiction, we'd ask you affirm the judgment of the district court and find that Blake's claims are either without merit or the record insufficient to address them. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal?
No, Your Honor.
There is no time for rebuttal, counsel. You are excused, and the court will go on to the next case of the day, which is Ortega versus Pena.